one of those all-star lineup of Rabban is Rav Shai Schechter, and we have a very big privilege to be able to hear some Torah from him today.
Okay, so good morning, everybody, and welcome back. I can say I am extremely jealous of all of you because I attempted to go to Eretz Yisrael twice over the last few months, and I was rejected both times. I just booked my ticket for the third attempt. Maybe we'll be successful this time, but if not for anything else, the fact that you all had the opportunity to be in Eretz Yisrael this summer and to spend time learning in Eretz Yisrael and appreciating what Eretz Yisrael is all about, that in itself is already a very worthwhile endeavor. So welcome back to all of you. I'm sorry that you're back in Chutz La'aretz and that we didn't come to meet you there. Halavai, we should all have the opportunity and the schus to live in Eretz Yisrael and to be a part of Torah's Eretz Yisrael, but if we can't do that right now, at least we have the opportunity to bring back the experience and to learn Torah here together. So as we know, we're approaching the Yom Noraim. And I know that the last few days, Josh told me that there were some different shiurim about various aspects of tshuva and how we're supposed to approach some of the season of Elul that we are now engaged in. So there's a basic premise, there's a basic understanding when we talk about tshuva that HaKadosh Baruch Hu yearns and he desires very much our tshuva. But not only does he desire it, he encourages it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is very supportive and reassuring of our attempt to do tshuva. How do we know that? On Yom Kippur, one of the tefillos that we say is Atan Nosein Yad LaPoshim, which means, you God, you HaKadosh Baruch Hu, give a hand to the person who does something wrong. What does that mean? It means Hashem extends a hand to us. He says, here, I'm giving you the lifeline. I want you to use it. I want you to take advantage of it. And I want you to do tshuva. And that really is something that we need to appreciate. The outstretched and expansive hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who promotes and who really wants to stimulate us to do tshuva. Now, in that same vein, we find that many, many different times throughout Jewish history, there were some of the great Talmidei Chachamim, some of them in the times of the Mishnah, some of the times of the Gemara, and some of the times of the Rishonim, who made different kinds of mechanisms, different kinds of ways, procedures in which a person would be encouraged to do tshuva. They didn't want a person to be humiliated when they've done something wrong. They want a person to feel that I have the opportunity and I have the ability to do tshuva for what I've done wrong. So let's go through a few of those examples just to appreciate a little bit what this is all about and how important it is to encourage someone to come closer to the path of tshuva. Let's look at the first entry over here, which is the Gemara Maseches Sota Daf Lamed Beis. So the Gemara here talks about how the Shemona Esrei, how the davening was configured. Anybody ever think about it? Certain parts of davening we say out loud, other parts of davening we say silently. So why is that? Why is it that when I say certain parts, I'm supposed to be quiet, and certain parts I'm supposed to say it out loud? So the Gemara actually addresses this. And the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Yochai, just to give everybody a little bit of a context, Rabbi Yochanan was a Tana or an Amora? Anybody know? I know I'm going to sound like my father's son when I ask these questions. Anybody know? Rabbi Yochanan, I am my father's son, so that's why I ask these questions. Rabbi Yochanan was a Tana or an Amora. What? Amora. So Amoraim lived before or after the Tanaim? Amoraim were involved in the Mishnayos or the Gemara? The Gemara, good. So the Tanaim were the ones who authored the Mishnah. Who is the one who actually cataloged and put down all the Mishnayos into writing? Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Right? Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the last generation of Tanaim. You know, it's interesting when we talk about Jewish history and we think about the Tanaim, we say, yeah, all the Tanaim were friends, they all lived at the same time. It's like the same way as saying that I was a good friend of Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Or I'm a good friend of the Chafetz Chaim. We live, I guess, when you look at the whole expanse of Jewish history, we lived around the same time. Within the last 200 years, sounds like it's around the same time, but it's not at all the same time. I'm not a contemporary, I mean, I'm not a good example. Even if I lived in the same generation as Rabbi Akiva Eiger, I would not be called a contemporary of his. But none of the Gedolim of our generation are called a contemporary of Rabbi Akiva Eiger or of the Chafetz Chaim either. So same with the Tanaim. The period of the Tanaim was 200 years. So that was a long period of history, and not all the Tanaim knew each other. Obviously, some of them were alive when other ones were not yet born. So it's the same thing here. But certainly the Amoraim were not alive when the Tanaim were alive. So this is very strange. Rabbi Yochanan, you just said, was an Amora. Rabbi Shimon Yochai was a Tana. So what does this mean? Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Yochai. That's very interesting. It's a line that you find very often in the Gemara that Rabbi Yochanan quotes in the name of Rabbi Shimon Yochai, but there were like two or three generations in between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon Yochai. He never actually met him. So it's just interesting when you read a Gemara to first understand the context. Who's talking? What are they quoting? Where are they quoting from? And how did he hear this from Reb Shimon Yochai? Reb Shimon Yochai died many, many years before Reb Yochanan was born. So how did he come to quote Shimon Yochai? Interesting. Anyway, not for now. So the Gemara says, "Mipnei ma tiknu tefila balachash? You told me I only have till 11:10. Well, chatzi shir asa min haTorah. So this is going to be difficult. Okay. So the Gemara says, "Mipnei ma tiknu tefila balachash?" I'm going to put myself on double speed. Why do they have that Shmona Esrei is said silently? Why do we daven tefila balachash? So the Gemara says the reason why shelo levayish es ofrei aver, because we don't want to humiliate. We don't want there to be any shame or embarrassment for somebody who violated an aver. Rashi says, Hamisvadim al avera shebiyadam. Believe it or not, there are some people in the world who actually take davening seriously. There are some people in the world who, when they say slach lanu, when they say hashivenu avinu l'sarasecha, they actually feel bad about the fact that they've done an avera. Can you believe that? So therefore, the Gemara says, what's going to happen? We're going to come to shul one day, everybody's going to be davening out loud, and one guy in the middle of the davening, hashivenu avinu l'sarasecha, he's going to break down crying, he's going to say slach lanu, he's going to be totally overwhelmed, and everyone's going to be staring at him. So we don't want that to happen because we don't want to embarrass him. And we want to encourage the person who's doing tshuva. And therefore, we made an institution across the board that everybody who daven Shemona Esrei has to daven silently, kidei shelo levayish es ofrei aveira, because we don't want to embarrass the person who violates an aveira and then ends up crying in the middle of Shemona Esrei. We have a similar Mishnah Meseches Gittin. So the Mishnah here writes, an interesting case, and this also comes up in Meseches Sukkah. Anybody here learning Sukkah or has learned Sukkah? Anybody? You learned? So do you know Takanas Marish? Are you familiar with that? What is it? Maybe enlighten all those who have not yet learned Masechah Sukkah. This guy's like a Bucky and Shas. You hear this? Maybe you could tell us what daf is that on. No, I'm joking. I have no idea. So the Gemara says in Masechah's Gittin about the Takanas Marish. What is the Takanas Marish? So you just told us the following. I have a contractor and he's building a building and he's building somebody a house or whatever it might be. He's building an office building. And it turns out that when he went to Lowe's that day, they didn't have all the equipment that he needed. They didn't have all the beams that he needed to build a house. So he decides to go to his friend, to go to his neighbor. He steals a couple of beams, puts it into the building. He figures the other guy's not even going to realize, not even going to notice. Obviously, he violated Lo Sigzo, whatever it might be. He's not allowed to steal. But he then steals the beams, puts it into the building, continues on building the house. And now you have a beautiful house. The problem is some of the foundational beams of this house were stolen. It's from somebody else. So the Gemara says, now he feels bad about it. And he says, how am I going to repay the person who I stole the money from? Well, the Heshev es Agzela means, when I'm supposed to give back that which I stole, it means you have to give back that which you stole. So if it's still intact, I have to give back that which I took from somebody else. The problem is here, that means I have to dismantle the entire house, and then I have to take out the foundational beams that I stole, and give it back to the friend. Well, how can I do that? Does the Torah expect me to take down a whole house in order to give back the beam that's on the bottom? What would you say? All those who are in favor of taking apart the whole house, raise your hands. Why is nobody raising their hands? The right answer is you should take down the house. No? Let me give you another example. Everybody here has heard of Reb Chaim Kanievsky? Okay. So Reb Chaim Kanievsky's whole life is learning Torah. Right? He knows nothing else. He does nothing else. I actually have a friend who was once by Reb Chaim Kanievsky when we were in yeshiva. So I'm now 35. So when I was 19, I had a friend who was in yeshiva, and he went to eat Reb Chaim Kanievsky's house on a Shabbos. And somebody at the table asked Reb Chaim Kanievsky, are you allowed to play basketball on Shabbos? So Reb Chaim asked them, what exactly is basketball? So they said, well, there's two teams, and there's two baskets and a ball, and you go back and forth, and you put the ball in the basket each side, you have points. So he said, I don't understand the shaila. Why can't you just put it in the basket before Shabbos? So, it's an amazing story. Why is it an amazing story? That he actually has no idea what a basketball is, and even when they explain it to him, he still has no idea what it is, because his whole life is learning Torah. So, I know somebody who built a mansion in Shari Chesed in Yerushalayim. Anybody here visited Shari Chesed this summer? So, there are a lot of very simple houses there, and a lot of very beautiful houses there. So, there's somebody who built a monstrosity of a house there, and he invited Reb Chaim Kanievsky to come look at the house. Why do you invite him to come look at the house? You think Reb Chaim cares about the house? No. Reb Chaim doesn't care about anything, but Reb Chaim was schlepped there by his driver to come put up the mezuzah in this guy's house. Okay, so the guy decided once he has the opportunity to have Reb Chaim in the house, he's going to walk him around all the rooms, and he's going to ask him, should I put the mezuzah on this side, on that side, here, or there, up, down? So he walked him around. And sometimes Hilchos Mezuzah is not so simple. Sometimes it gets very complicated. So he is walking around the house. Reb Chaim told him, on this doorway, you put it on this side, and that one, you put it over there, a little higher, a little lower. Then he gets to the most beautiful room in the house, and that was this man's study. And that room has like one entranceway that leads into another one, that leads into a third one, and there's drop ceilings, and a whole bunch of complicated things when you walk into the room. It's really fancy. And it was a major shaila about where to put the mezuzah. So he was excited to show this room to Reb Chaim. So he walks Reb Chaim in and he says, oh, look, this is the study. Where do I put the mezuzah? Chaim says, ze she'ila chamura. It's a serious shaila. I'm not sure. And then he starts to laugh. So this man turns to Reb Chaim's son and he asks him, what's he laughing? What's so funny? I asked him a shaila. He said, my father told me, when you weren't looking, my father told me that you don't understand what he means when I say it's a serious shaila. You think it's a serious shaila means it's a serious shaila where to put the mezuzah. My father meant it's a serious shaila whether you're allowed to live in this house. How can you live in a house when you don't know where to put a mezuzah? Who would live in such a house? Who would live in such a house where they don't know where to put a mezuzah? That's the way certain people think. It's the way we're supposed to think. Now, we don't think that way because we're worried about the house, we're worried about this, that. Reb Chaim says, you should be worried about the mezuzah. If you don't know where to put up a mezuzah, knock down the house and start all over again. What's the question? Anyway, so again, I ask you this question. Somebody steals a beam from another person. I see we're really not going to get through anything here, but I'm glad you all had a chance to learn something today. So when I go and I steal a beam from someone and I put it into a house, what should the answer be? How do I do tshuva? What's the answer? Anybody who's listening to the story I just said? The answer is, knock down the house. You stole something, right? If you stole something, you have to give it back. I built a house with it. Too bad you built a house with it. You shouldn't have stolen and then built a house. It's your problem. And if you didn't think about that before, that's too bad. But the Gemara says, we came up with this idea called Takanas HaShavin, better known as Takanas Marish, which means, how is the person going to feel when we tell them you have to knock down the whole project and start all over again? It's going to cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars just to give back one beam that you stole. You think he's ever going to do tshuva? Never. He's going to say, forget it. It's not worth it. I wanted to do the right thing. I wanted to give it back. Forget about it. It's not kedai. It's not worth it. So he's just going to forget about the whole issue and he's going to move on with his life. So in order to encourage somebody to do tshuva, we came up with this idea and we said, even though normally the halacha is that you have to give back that which you stole, in this very unusual circumstance, we say that you're allowed to get away with just paying for it. And you don't have to give it back intact. Okay? A third example. The Psukim tell us in Sefer Vayikra, Lo sonu ish es amiso. Anybody ever heard of that? What is that better known as? It's a lav in the Torah. No. Oh, so interesting. So you said that was a trick. Ona'a, right, is one thing. Ona'as Devarim is something else. What is Ona'ah? Ona'ah is a sugya in Bab Metzia. Ona'ah is when you charge too much money for an item that somebody wants to buy. That's one thing. Not connected at all to the Isser De'araisa of Ona'as Devarim. So it's similar. And spelled the same way, but Ona'as Devarim means that you're not allowed to torment people with words. You're not allowed to cause them pain. You can't harass them with words. If you tease someone, that's called Ona'as Devarim. Now again, most people are not evil, vicious. Most people, when they say a funny line to another friend, the friend is, that's the way they talk, that's the way they communicate. That's not what it means. Ona'as Devarim means when I say something to another person and I know it's going to hurt them, and I know it's embarrassing to them. Now, there could be a million and one examples of that, but the Rambam gives us a very clear example. And the Rambam says, what would Ona'ah be? Ona'as Devarim says, the Rambam number Gimel, Imhaya Baal Tshuva. If somebody is a Baal Tshuva, somebody had a very difficult past, and now they have done tshuva, and now they're on the right path, and they're doing the right thing. So the Rambam says, Lo yomar lo, you're not allowed to tell him, Zechor ma'asecha rishonim. You're not allowed to tell about tshuva. Do you remember, I remember when you used to be involved in these things, and you had that long hair, and I know who you used to hang out with, and you used to go to those clubs, and you used to smoke over here. He doesn't want to hear that. Now he's put his life together, and now he's happy, and now he's on a good path. He doesn't want to think about his past. That would be, says the Rambam, Ona'as Devarim, an Isser De'araisa, to talk to a person about their negative past. Again, because we want to encourage people to feel comfortable doing tshuva. How's it going to feel? A guy says, you know, I'm committed, I want to be a Baal Tshuva. Okay, wonderful. Now you become a Baal Tshuva. Guy shows up in a community, and all everybody's talking about is what they used to do in the past. I don't want to think about my past. I want to only move forward. I want to think about my future. And if I'm going to put the person back into their past, it's going to hold them back from being interested in doing tshuva. So those are three very interesting examples. It happens to be about 1,000 years ago in the 10th century. How many people have heard of Rabbeinu Gershom? Right? Rabbeinu Gershom. What do we know about Rabbeinu Gershom? Anything? He was interesting. He lived in the times of the Rishonim. Rashi actually writes, in one of the tshuvas that Rashi wrote, Rashi writes that Rabbeinu Gershom was like the father of all the Rishonim. Rashi was one of the earlier Rishonim. And he looked to Rabbeinu Gershom as really one of the foundational pillars of the times of the Rishonim. Rabbeinu Gershom was known as Ma'or HaGola. Rabbeinu Gershom Ma'or HaGola. Sometimes if you read a sefer, it says Reish Gimel Mem Hei. That stands for Rabbeinu Gershom Ma'or HaGola. Ma'or HaGola means he was the light onto the gullus, because he was considered to be a very foundational personality in the days of the Rishonim. So Rabbeinu Gershom got an interesting shayla. And his shayla was, there was a kohen who became a Meshumad. Meshumad means he served Avodah Zarah. He no longer believed in God. So it says that this kohen became a Meshumad, and then he did tshuva. And the kohen shows up in shul after doing tshuva, and he decides that he wants the duchen. And a whole fight breaks out in shul. This kohen says, I'm a kohen. Why shouldn't I be allowed to duchen? And people in the community say, what are you talking about? We don't want to accept bracha from you. You're not somebody who we would put up to do anything. You were an Ovid Avodah Zarah. I remember when you were a Christian pastor. You were running the church. You think you're going to come into our shul now? You're lucky enough that we let you have a seat in shul. Now you think you're going to get up in front of the whole community, in front of the whole congregation, and you're also going to do Birchas Kohanim? No way. So they sent the shayla to Rabbeinu Gershom. And Rabbeinu Gershom has an amazing discussion about it, and he writes, Afal Pishachata, he says, even though you're right, he did a terrible thing and he served Avodah Zarah, and it doesn't get much worse than serving Avodah Zarah. Rabbeinu Gershom said, the bottom line is, now he did tshuva. So now we should let him back. And he gets into a discussion, why should we let him back? Now, number one, Rabbeinu Gershom says, I look through all of Tanakh, I look through all the Gemara, and I don't see any apparent or obvious glaring raya that tells me that I should disqualify this person from the Nesias Kapayim. So it's just an interesting way of dealing with the shayla. Rabbeinu Gershom says, if I have somebody's life on the line, right here, I'm going to embarrass this person by telling them they can never do Nesias Kapayim. Everybody knows he's a kohen. And yet, I'm going to say that because I'm not sure, you know what, let's be machmir and we're going to tell you, you can't duchen because we're going to err on the side of caution. Says Rabbeinu Gershom, I don't understand. I look through all of Shas, I look through all of Chumash, I don't see any clear proof that says that this person is not allowed to duchen. If that's the case, then how can I disqualify him without a clear and obvious raya in doing so? So that's number one. But then he moves a little bit further and he says the following. Let's read it together. Let's read together what he says. Hilkach, ein lanu raya lo mina mikra v'lo mina mishna l'poslo. I was not able to find, now again, you have to be Rabbeinu Gershom to know all of the Mishnayos and all of the Gemara and everything else that came before that to know that there is no clear raya, that there is no clear proof from the Gemara or the Mishnayos or the Psukim. But he knew that. And he says, Ela sheyesh lanu siyua mina mikra o mi mishna shelo l'poslo. It seems that from the absence of any source in the Mishnah or the Psukim, it must be that we should not disqualify this person, and we should allow this Baal Tshuva to then go ahead and engage in the mitzvah of Nesias Kapayim. Then he goes further and he says why. Ba'on nimtzeis, he says the reason why I would say is because, and this is his foundational, fundamental argument that he makes, why should we allow this person to do Nesias Kapayim? He says the reason why is because if you're not going to, Atamarpe Yideim Shabale Tshuva. You're going to discourage Bale Tshuva from ever doing tshuva. Velo Nachon Lasos Kane. You can't do that. V'im Tomar, and if you're going to say, Lo Yale Leduchan Velo Yikra Batora Tchila, if you're going to tell this Kohen, you know what? You blew it. You used to be a wonderful Jew. You were a Kohen, and I'm sorry. You made a horrible mistake. You went and you served Avodah Zarah, and therefore you are no longer worthy to get the first aliyah. You're no longer worthy to do Nesias Kapayim. We don't want to accept your bracha. Meharer b'libo b'shmad. You don't think he's going to think, you know, maybe I should just go back to the way I was. It was a better life. I was an Ovid Avodah Zarah. I was a Christian. I was doing my thing. Nobody bothered me. Everybody gave me the respect that I deserved. And all of a sudden, I come to the Jewish community and nobody wants to talk to me. Nobody wants to hear from me. What do you think it's going to make him do? And he writes, imagine if we were the cause for him to revert back to his old ways. Imagine if we were the cause, we turned them off. And therefore he writes, So this was a recurrent theme that we find not only in the Mishnah and in the Gemara. Again, we saw Rav Shimon Yochai as quoted by Rabbi Yochanan. We saw it in the Takanas Barish, the Gemara Maseches Sukkah, as well as the Gemara in Maseches Gittin. We find it here and in many other places where there's this emphasis that we try to put on somebody being encouraged to do tshuva. We want to do whatever we can to be supportive of somebody who sincerely wants to do tshuva. So much so, the Maharal Rutenberg. Anybody know the Maharal Rutenberg? When did he live? What? Who is his Talmud, his foremost Talmud?
The Rush.
The Rush, right, very good. So the Maharal Rutenberg was a Talmud of, was the Rebbe of the Rush. Anybody know how the Maharal Rutenberg died? What? He died in jail. Fascinating story. Terrible story. Tragic story. What happened with the Maharal Rutenberg was that the local authorities had a great idea. And they found out that Maharal Rutenberg was the greatest Talmud Chacham, the most respected person in the community. And they said, if we're going to put him in jail and we'll hold the Jewish community up for ransom, then we're going to make a lot of money. So they took the Maharal Rutenberg, they put him in jail, and the plan was that the Jewish community was going to raise the money to then get him out. Of course, they were going to pay whatever amount of money it was that was necessary to get him out. Now, that money was raised, and the Maharal Rutenberg made a psak that they're not allowed to give the money for his ransom. And he said, even if it means that he's going to live out his life and die in jail, that's what he would prefer. Why? Because he said, then it will never end. After you put up the ransom for me, then they're going to take the next person. And they're just going to keep on doing this. We have to show the community that we're going to put our foot down. We're not going to stand by this. And if you want to take somebody, we're not going to give in. We don't negotiate with terrorists. We're not going to give in. We will not put up the money. And we will not have this ever happen again. And that is what happened. Unfortunately, the Maharal Rutenberg passed away in jail because he was never able to get out. And this actually became relevant. I'm sure many of you have heard of the story of Entebbe, right? So the story of Entebbe was that there was a whole plane that was diverted to a foreign country, and they were stuck there. Anybody know who the most prominent member of that of those hostages were? Yeah, Rav Huttner, right? So Rav Huttner was the Rosh Hashiva in Chaim Berlin, and he was a very well-known personality here in America. And the question was, what do we do? So there were many in America who said, "Look, if there are going to be people who are stuck wherever they are, so that's a terrible thing, obviously. But how can Rav Huttner be stuck there? Maybe we should put up money that at least they should release Rav Huttner." And apparently at the time, Rav Huttner said, absolutely not. I think they went to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, if I'm not mistaken, and they asked him what to do. And he said, based on the story of the Maharal Rutenberg, we don't have a right to give ransom for one person because then the terrorists are going to think this is a great idea. We'll go after the next Rosh Hashiva. And the Jewish community is going to do that again. So that's something that, again, is a unfortunately recurrent theme throughout Jewish history. It's something that we found has come up again and again. But the original story was with the Maharal Rutenberg. And the Maharal Rutenberg has a tshuva where he writes that there was a cherem. He put a cherem on somebody. What does it mean to be in cherem? To be in cherem means you're excommunicated. What does it mean to be? It's a word that we don't use in any other context. Who knows what excommunicated even means? Excommunicated means you're out of the community. Means you can't join a minyan. You're not allowed to shop in the stores. You can't send your kids to the school. You're in cherem. You're on the outs. You know what cherem really means? The Gemara says cherem is the same three letters as something else. Cherem is ches, resh, mem. Right? That's the way you spell cherem. What else is those letters? Rachem. True. But that's not relevant here. What's another one? Configure it again. You're close. Oh, you can get this. What? Machar, tomorrow. Good. Okay. Also not what we need. What is a third way to configure the words? Think about it. Huh? Ramach. What's ramach?
Spear.
What?
Spear.
Romach is a spear. Good. Ramach, right? When we talk about the human body, we say that we have ramach evar mushesagidim. Ramach evar means we have 200 and, higher mathematics here, 200 and 48 limbs. So ramach evar is the makeup of the human body. The Gemara happens to say in Bechoros that it seems that that's only the makeup of a male body. The Gemara says in Bechoros a strange story that there was a woman who was arrested and in the end she lost her life and the authorities, whatever it was, and the Chacham said, oh, this is a great opportunity. We should do an autopsy. Somebody was just killed by the local authorities. A terrible story, terrible thing. But now we have a cadaver. Why don't we do an autopsy and we'll find out about the human body? So it says that the Chachamim took this woman's body, and they asked permission from whoever it was, and they did an autopsy, and they came to the shocking recognition that it seems we always thought that there were 248 limbs in the male body. Turns out there are 252 in the female body, which is why, by the way, when we make a Mishaberach V'cholim, I know this all has nothing to do with tshuva. It's interesting anyway, I hope. So it happens to be when we make a Mishaberach V'cholim, so you'll notice that when we make a Mishaberach for a man, we say one thing. When we make a Mishaberach for a woman, we say a different thing. Ever notice that? So when we make a Mishaberach for a man, we say, what do we say? That he should have a refuah shlema l'ramach evarav v'shasagidav. Right? We say that he should have a refuah for his 248 limbs. When we make it for a woman, we say l'chol evarav l'chol gideah. Why? That's based on the Gemara Bechoris, where the Gemara says, well, not really sure. Does a woman have 248 limbs? If she has 252, and we're only wishing that she should have a refuah shlema on 248, that would be terrible. We're saying, yeah, only 248 of your limbs should be well. The rest of them, we don't really care about. That's wrong. And that's why we switch the nusach when we daven for a woman, and we say, L'chol evareh u'l'chol gideh. It happens to be a shayla in the achronim. What happens if you have somebody who has an amputated body part? So would you change the nusach when you're davening for a refuah shlema for them? They don't have 248 limbs. Anyway, not relevant to our discussion here, but the Maharam writes that there was a cheirim that was placed on a certain individual. What does a cheirim actually mean? The Gemara says, Cheirem is the same letters as Ramach. What's the significance of Ramach? Cheirem means we don't just excommunicate. We don't just throw someone out of the community and say, you can't shop in the stores, you can't join a minyan, you can't send your kids to school. It's not just that. It's much worse. A cheirem means we put a curse on the person's Ramach Evarim. We put a klala, a curse on the person's Ramach Evarim, and we say, we hope that your Ramach Evarim will no longer continue to exist. That's what a cheirem means. Now, that's really serious. We throw around the word, put someone in cheirim, this and that. It's not so simple. Putting someone in cheirim in the times of Chazal meant there was a klala that was placed on that person that their ramach evarim should cease to exist. That's a serious klala. Now, this cheirim that the Maharami Rutenberg came up with was, I'm going to read it to you, cheirim, he made a cheirim, shelo levayesh balei tshuva me'avonam bifnehem. You are not allowed to be to embarrass about tshuva and talk about their averos that they have done in their past. There was a cheirim on such a person. Can you imagine? I would have said, put a cheirim on a person who's a mechalel Shabbos, put a cheirim on a person who's whatever it might be. No, says Rabbeinu Gershom. All of that, people do averos, people make mistakes. The cheirim that Rabbeinu Gershom came up with here was a cheirim on a person who reminds a baal tshuva of the terrible mistakes they have made throughout their life. I think it just gives us a little bit of a context of how encouraging we need to be of people who sincerely want to do tshuva. As we said, I see we're out of time already, so we're going to stop with this thought. But as we said, we recite in the davening on Yom Naraim, Ata nosein yad laposhim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu extends a hand to those who want to do tshuva. He doesn't push us away. The Ribono Shel Olam structured his world in a way where he wants all of us to take advantage of this tremendous opportunity to do tshuva. Tshuva lefanai, Rabbeinu Yonah writes in one of the prakim, in one of the chapters in Shari Tshuva, he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God has a taina on us. And he says, I don't understand. I give you the rope, I give you the way to save yourself, and you just turn away and you say, I'm not interested? How can a person say such a thing? God gives you the biggest gift in the world, you're just going to say, I don't need it? You're going to say, I'm not going to take advantage? HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us this amazingly incredible gift. And not only does He give it to us, the Chachamim of every generation have made takanos to make it easier for us to further encourage people to do tshuva. We don't want people to be embarrassed. We want them to be forthcoming. We want them to have opportunity. And that is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has put into our world, into our society, into our community. It's what all the Chachamim have tried so valiantly to do to help make the tshuva process accessible to all of us. And yet, so often, we have this experience of Chodesh Elul, of Rosh Hashanah, of Yom HaKippurim, Aseres Yimei Tshuva, and it just flies by like nothing ever happened. People don't realize the gift that Tshuva really is. And that's really the opportunity that all of us have. I know that you're already back from Eretz Yisrael, and some of the tremendous inspiration that you may have had there is not going to be exactly the same as it may be here in the United States. Well, let's remind ourselves that this time of year is a very uplifting time of year. There's something very special about this time of year. It's a very auspicious time of year. It's a time when HaKadosh Baruch Hu outstretches His hand to all of us. and gives us this tremendous gift and this unbelievable opportunity and experience of coming back to Him. Shuva Elai v'ashuva Aleichem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, return to me and I will return to you. And that's the gift that He gives all of us, and all we need to do is take full advantage of that incredibly powerful tool that HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts into our lives and into our experience. So I wish all of you tremendous hatzlacha.